is open. We're going to continue our updating our tax policy informational hearings with a look at property taxes, estate tax, and the transportation tax world. I know there have been a few changes on that in the last year. So unless anyone has anything to begin with, let's start with property taxes and call up Dr. Jamie McGovern.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jamie McGovern with the Legislative Revenue Office, and I'm going to be giving both the presentations on property taxes and estate taxes. So we have a very veteran committee here, and so I know that many of you are experts in the property tax system, so I'm going to try and make it as short and painless as possible. To the extent that you have questions, it could lengthen out, but that's going to probably determine how in-depth we get. And I'll talk a little bit about the system, but also some things that are on the table. Okay, so the basis for Oregon's property tax system is Measure 5 and Measure 50, and this came up a little bit in the legislative days. In 1990 and 1997, they created restrictions on the cap that can be charged to property owners in terms of the tax rates compared to their real market value. And also, it created what's called a permanent rate, also established something that was new called an assessed value. So that came up last time in terms of the situation that we have, where we have a disparity in taxes that are paid for property owners of similar properties, and where that started was back in 1996 with the creation of an assessed value versus a real market value. And I'll say that a lot of, similar to what Kyle said this morning, a lot of the data that I'm going to talk about comes from the Department of Revenue, so there can be a one-year lag, and there's a difference in the receipts and the tax bills for each year, so we're going to look at a little bit of both of those. So to that extent, there's something called the CPR that is integral in determining what people pay for taxes on their property. So individuals get assessed property tax, an assessed value on their property, which is different than their real market value, and then they pay a tax rate on that. That CPR is an important component, and the key implications of Measure 5 and Measure 50, since they are now embedded in the Constitution, that almost all major changes to property taxes have to go to the voters. And the CPR is instrumental in determining how much money a local district can raise. And so a couple years ago, before my time here, HB 2088 was passed, and Gresham found that they weren't able to raise enough money because they were part of Multnomah County. Multnomah County had an assessed value to real market value, or CPR ratio, that was close to 0.6, and that was making it difficult for Gresham to raise money because they weren't seeing the appreciation real market values that the rest of, or parts of Multnomah County were seeing. And so now the CPR for Gresham is determined locally. So I don't have a comprehensive list here of the bills that are up regarding property tax, but there have been conversations around the building, I'm sure for years, but people are concerned about the disparity in property taxes that people pay. So there's HJR1 moves gradually the CPR to 0.75. And so people that have an assessed value to real market value ratio lower than 0.75 would move up, and people that have a ratio that's higher would move down. There's also some other similar measures to sort of change the approach to people's property tax bills. If the property tax is over $1 million, to set the assessed value identical to the real market value, that's an HAR 2. And the Joint Resolution 3 for commercial industrial, to set assessed value identical to the real market value. Then there's a couple, Joint Resolution 4 for commercial and industrial, to have no compression. And so that they would pay the full impact of the tax without Measure 5 compression. Then there's a couple bills revolving around homestead exemptions, and one of them is Senate Bill 209 to give a homestead exemption of $10,000 in the property value. There are various other bills regarding property tax changes throughout this session, but there's also one that I have been told that I can discuss a little bit, that's LZ 3495, which hasn't been dropped yet, but this would be a proposal to repeal Measure 5 and Measure 50 from the Constitution. And so Measure 5 and Measure 50 are what create the restrictions on the property tax system. There's something a little different, which is Senate Joint Resolution 1, which is up here, which asks the voters to approve permission for the legislature to set property taxes so that they are fair and equitable, notwithstanding the current laws in the Constitution for property taxes. Okay. I'm going to give a little bit of quick updates on the data and the revenue and numbers for the most recent property tax year. Not counting urban renewal, $6.5 billion was imposed on property owners. Most of the numbers that you'll see will be increases over the previous year. 6.6 was extended, and so that means there was a little bit of compression around the state, but compression decreased by 7%. And that should make a lot of sense, because compression is implemented by the real market value, and real market values have sort of taken off around the state in the past year. All counties, with the exception of Morrow, saw tax revenue increase. So they kind of increased across the board. I think I saw Josephine County increase by 18%, and Multnomah County was close to 10%. And Morrow County was the only county that saw a decrease. Josephine County, by the way, I talked to them, and they had passed a couple bonds, which were instrumental in increasing their tax revenue as well to that double-digit percentage. Just to give a perspective of how property tax fits in, if it were part of the general fund, it would be approximately 40% of total revenue. And so some states approach property tax differently, and ours is local, but in terms of revenue, it's a large percent of tax that Oregon collects. Okay, so the real market value also went up for the property around the state. And assessed value was at $404 billion. Both of those increased significantly. Real market value increased by more than the assessed value increased. Urban renewal also found an increase because they're taking the tax revenue that's assessed on the increased value portion of property that improves after it's frozen for urban renewal. And not only do they get the revenue from that, but then when there's general growth around the county, they experience the sort of rising tide that everyone else in Oregon experienced last year. Okay, so to speak about exemptions for a minute, or the money that the counties don't collect. So if you notice that this is for the biennium, and so if this year total tax revenue, including urban renewal, was about $6.7 billion, the estimated revenues of $15.4 billion for 2019 to 21 fall in line with that. And the exemptions that the property tax system sees are relatively large, but the majority of those fall into three large categories. There's an exemption of $2.6 billion for state and local property, $1.7 billion for federal property, and $1.5 billion for exemption of personal property for personal use. And then the other really large component that's not state and federal is the SIP program, or the Special Investments Program, and that's $500 million.
The personal property exemption, can you explain that a little bit? And the reason I'm asking the question is that if you don't file, because it's not, they don't go out and assess this, if you don't file, then the county doesn't have the information. So is the county, that big chunk of change, $1.9 billion, I think you said, something in that category, does that mean that their individuals are filing with the county and then the county is exempting it? Or how is that number coming about? And while you're at it, because you'll have to come back, because I'm guessing you're writing the note down here, the question would be on the government, the two government categories, or the government categories you have there, have we actually centrally assessed those? And do we have real numbers? Or are those scientific guesses? And one last question for you to ponder, since this is going to be a big topic, is coming back with why do we care about real market value? And the reason I raise that question is that we presently utilize assessed value. So even if you have a brand new house and you just built it, it's the assessed value that's important. And in many cases, it could be near identical to real market value because it's a new house. And if you talk about changing all of this, which I think now maybe we're going to have a serious discussion on that. See, I'm correct. The problem comes about is that who cares and who cared about real market value? And I'll give you a good example. During the downturn when you were not here, and some of us were on this revenue committee, it was very interesting to see that the real market value during a housing collapse of 30-some percent in many cases was going up, skyrocketing. And I'll tell you, if Bob sitting in the back room there owns a house and it's in downtown Portland and was built in 1936, he doesn't care about the real market value and frankly has ignored it. All he's worried about is the assessed value. And And my point being in this is, have we looked and are we assessing and anticipating that if we changed something, or people, the voters changed something, how valid are these real market values? Because I can tell you, I do business in 3 counties, and now because of the legislature, people are now looking at their real market value saying, hey, we should like get this thing fixed, because they didn't care about it. So when the assessor says their $186,000 house was now worth $296,000, they just didn't care because the assessed value was at $129,000. And I know we've always traditionally seen, Chris, you brought them before, and before Doc has brought them before and said, okay, you know, here's what we've lost. But if you got to calculate this, we're also going, somebody's going to have to calculate the fact that the first time this thing were to pass and come out, people are going to blow a gasket, and then they're going to go back and say, is this really worth it? You know, meaning, you know, how many property tax appeals are we going to have, so on and so forth?
The way I always think about it in terms of some of this, I mean, you've touched on a lot of things, but some of the data issues, the best data that we have are those figures that are directly relevant to determining tax. So whether we're talking about taxable income on the income side or assessed value on the property side, the assessed value is probably a better number than the RMV. The RMV is relevant for Measure 5 compression, so it's not completely irrelevant.
Right.
But once it gets to a certain level, and I think the legislature is going to hear more about this issue and the accuracy of the RMV and the extent to which assessors have enough resources to effectively go out and put accurate RMVs on the roll.
Right, exactly. So if you're going to do, my point is, if we do a transition, we're going to have to address those county issues. And the issue of making sure that our home addresses are removed from the record, so when they come to our house and lynch us until they get it fixed, okay, it's there. But it is a real issue, because I've talked to several of my assessors and looked at it, and it's like they don't spend the time. I mean, they use the CPR, but they don't spend the time, and most people just don't, because it's so wide a differential, they don't address it. And if we do change it, and voters are very likely to vote for United States senators called Senator Hass, Senator Benz, Senator Boquist, to call us 50% of the time, they may think this is a good idea if it goes to the ballot, and then when it happens, once it gets out of the other side, might be fine, but it's that transitional page.
And we are actively, for all of the estimates we do, anytime we rely on the RMV data, which is what we have, it's always in the back of our mind.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I do have to come back to you on some of those questions. And I think that I've heard anecdotally from the Department of Revenue that the BOPTA appeals have significantly decreased once the current system was in place. And also that I was talking with some people today to find out how property that is exempted is tracked in terms of the value, and that's a similar concern. Also referring to your first question, when a piece of property is exempted, it's possibly tracked initially and then not followed up on or not continually assessed, and so that those are sort of overlaying issues.
Well, I can assure you, Doctor, that we're all going to learn about BOPTA very shortly if we do this.
Okay. Thank you. So I was, in this slide, I've just taken some of the information from the Department of Revenue. They break out property by property class. And the red bar is the, and also referring to the previous question about assessed value versus real market value, in this slide, I decided to use assessed value because of exactly for that reason, that it's much more verifiable. And so the amount of property that is owned in the state as a share, and so you could say that residential property owners own approximately 53% of the value of the property in the state when it comes to assessed value and their share. And they pay approximately 56% of the taxes, or 56.5% of the property taxes. And then you can go through the other property classes. For commercial and industrial, they own approximately 18% of all the value of property in the state, and they pay approximately 14.8% of the taxes. So one of the questions that has come up from the House Committee and also the Senate Committee is the question of the level of property taxes, and from individual members raising money, but also the disparity in the different property classes and individuals and what people pay if you had two houses next to each other, businesses or businesses versus residential homeowners. And so this just gives a little bit of shed some light on where the property taxes are collected and where the value sits in our property in the state. Okay, and just a tiny bit more on property taxes. It's a little bit fuzzy, but also where we sit around the country in terms of our property taxes. So if you were thinking of benchmarking, it's true that all the states do property taxes a little bit differently. Around the time that we implemented Measure 5 and Measure 50, Colorado, for instance, pegged their property tax to the proportion of ownership in the state. And Alaska has lower property taxes or higher property taxes, but gives these, you know, state rebates for living there. So there's all these kinds of things. Some of the states don't have income taxes. We don't have sales taxes. All those things being said, that we're different where we rank in terms of the entire country and in terms of our property taxes per capita, we're 26th. And for a medium homeowner, the rate at which we pay per value, dollar value of our home, we're kind of smack dab in the middle at 26 and 24. But I looked a little closer, and these numbers are from 2014, so they're a little bit outdated, but this was the last time that I could find that somebody had done a nationwide survey on property taxes. If you look at the West and compare us to our cohorts in that sense, Oregon does rank pretty high in terms of the effective tax rate for a median owner-occupied home. And so we're at 1.0%, and there are several states in the West that are quite a bit below 1%. And so that's just a sort of across the board in the U.S. If you look over towards the east, you can see that a lot of the states are the sort of darker colors, and so those are higher property tax states, and the Midwest as well. And the West tends to be a slightly lower property tax state, and then we're up at the high end of the West.
You've got to have anticipated this question. Just why is Hawaii at 0.27? It's so much radically different than everybody else.
You know what? I actually have a call into them because a few years before they weren't. And so I plan on having an answer to that question. And that could be also because their property values might be significantly higher than median owner-occupied home might be significantly higher. I know that Hawaii can be expensive, so. But I did have a call in to them for that question. Thank you. Okay. Short.
Was your close? Sweet. That was your dramatic conclusion?
Pardon me, Senator?
That was your dramatic conclusion?
Oh, done. That was my conclusion.
Thank you, Jamie. What? We do have a committee bill. It's a work in progress. Jamie mentioned it earlier, and I guess I'm having a hard time getting it right. I probably screwed you up when I gave you those things, Chris. But it would essentially ask voters to allow the legislature to change Measure 50 through statute, and not to raise money, not to eliminate it, but find the language to
tweak it, because it wasn't a terrible idea back in 1996 to stabilize property tax growth. It's just that the mechanics were flawed, and now they have to be fixed because they're so far out of whack. So that'll be a bill we'll have up in a few weeks, in an effort to fix the tale of two houses, the tale of two gas stations, only for an equity standpoint, not to raise money, cut taxes, raise taxes. So we'll see. Okay, you're gonna stay there and move to the estate tax.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jamie McGovern, I'm Legislative Revenue. And so similarly, I have short overview orientation on estate taxes. In Oregon, we haven't had really many changes in the past 6 years, since 2012, in terms of legal changes, but we've had some functional updates and revenue changes. So I'm just going to start this time with benchmarking us around the country. And I will I guess say that again, and throughout this building, there have been questions about how the estate tax works and what would happen if we changed it. I can say sort of anecdotally that in looking at the states, for instance, most of the states have a bracketing system like we do in Oregon. But when I looked at it at New York, for instance, I think there's like 21 tax brackets for New York. They have a lot of brackets, so it's a graduated system like we have, which we'll get to. Something like this. But the way that Oregon system works is that if you have an estate that's worth less than $1 million, you don't end up having to pay taxes on it. If you have an estate that's worth $1.5 million, you would have to pay taxes on that estate. Your estate would have to pay taxes, but only on the portion that was greater than $1 million. However, in the case of New York, for instance, once you hit their threshold, and I think their threshold is $5.7 million, then you have to pay taxes on all the down brackets. So there are differences in the approaches to bracketing in estate taxes. I also looked at we'll have a look at the estate tax revenue in Oregon, and I looked at what would happen if we eliminated one of the brackets or changed some of that. Okay, so and we used to have an inheritance tax, and that changed in 2012 to an estate tax when we separated from the federal government. And so the only way that we tie to the federal government in terms of the estate tax is by definition only. And currently, from the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, the federal government threshold is at $11.4 million compared to 2017, where it was $5.5 million. So we haven't kept up with that. We don't tie to that. We're still at $1 million. Okay, to be really dramatic, 100% tax just means every generation starts from scratch on estate taxes. You're not taxing somebody's income while they're alive. You're also not taxing the income of the beneficiaries. So for instance, the difference between an estate tax and an inheritance tax is you tax the actual estate by the value of the estate, not by the value that the individuals are receiving. So for instance, the difference is if you have a $10 million estate, under estate tax, you would tax that estate based on the $10 million bracket. If you had an inheritance tax and you had a $10 million estate and you had 10 people or beneficiaries that you were giving that to, they would individually be taxed based on their own income when they received that lump sum. And a 0% tax just means you are allowed to transfer 100% of the wealth to beneficiaries. Most of the governments fall somewhere in between. Okay. Another note about our tax brackets here, just to give some color, I guess, that a large percentage of the filers fall into the $1 million and $1 to $2.5 million category. So there's a large number of estate filers there. And so a lot of the revenue comes from the sort of what we might call down brackets. And so there's a small number of filers and a significant amount of money at the higher end, but it's sort of pinned into a couple filers. Okay, we also have a lot of deductions that make it so that if you have an estate, you don't necessarily pay taxes. And so that's why in this last chart, the first column, you might have an estate that's, say, worth $1.5 million. But by the time you're done taking the deductions, you could have a marital deduction, debt, funeral, those kinds of things, you might not end up paying taxes. You fall below $1 million. And in particular, we have something called the natural resource credit. And that's pretty significant. Oregon has it's presumed that the interest is in helping family-owned businesses that are centered around fishing, forestry, and farming. And so the natural resource credit is definitely utilized each year, and so that the revenue impact on a biennium is about $13 million. Okay. So you can see that each year we've had significant numbers of people claiming the natural resource credit. So this was a concern previously. That these family farms might disappear because they owe a lot of estate taxes. And if you have an estate that is worth less than $15 million and the majority of that is utilized in the natural resources, that's more than $7.5 million, then you can apply for the natural resource credit. If you have an estate that's worth more than $15 million, then your family farm, so to speak, doesn't qualify for the natural resource credit. Okay, so just some small updates on numbers. Estate tax is very lumpy, and so we had, this is payable tax, not necessarily receipt. So those are different from year to year. You can see that the largest number of filers is less than 1 million. And so that seems weird because you don't have to pay taxes unless your estate is worth more than 1 million. But these are estates that might have had, they had to file because of the threshold, but then when they took the deductions and finished filing, they don't actually owe any money. So there's 465 filers that their Oregon taxable estate is less than $1 million, and so that they don't owe taxes. But the gross estate is worth more than $1 million, which means that they have to file under the Oregon threshold. Okay. In terms of the general fund, it kind of hovers around 2%. And I think if we look at the next slide, it might have dropped from the year before. It's a significant part of the portion of the general fund at close to 2%, but it is not, it's not large. And you can see in the last year that there's been a drop, but it's also very lumpy. These are tax receipts. And so in the past year, there's been a drop in receipts. But estate tax is very strange because you have, after the death of a person, you have quite a long time to file. You have 9 months to file. And then there's another grace period that's after that. So you could have, I think, 16 months of a lag between the time of death and the time that the estate tax is paid.
This is dramatic. She's got slides at the end.
Yes, I just.
Well, because if there are more questions, I had additional information. But I.
Questions on the estate tax, and now there's a flurry of bills that, as there is every session, to repeal it, modify it, increase it. I think it was 1 year we had it. Was it the Oregon Law Commission that gave this an overhaul? Was that?
That's going back to 2012.
2012,
yeah.
Chair Haas, I did work on some stuff over the interim to see what would happen at different brackets. And so I can say that with the current tax bracket, if you moved to $2 million being the threshold instead of $1 million, that because all the top brackets pay that $1 to $2 million as well, so every single filer that is that has to pay taxes pays on those that first amount of the value of the estate above $1 million, that approximately half of the tax revenue goes away once you move that from $1 million to $2 million. So those incremental changes can be significant.
Questions? Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you.
Mazen Malin.
Afternoon, Chair Haas, members of the committee. I have to admit that that the last presentation made me feel old. That stuff we did a while ago. And
trying to read your first slide is making me feel old.
Yes. And as a matter of fact, I remember the first time when I was doing a presentation on property tax, you were in the House, Mr. Chair, in the House Revenue Committee. And I remember all of you from the House at different times. So, and yesterday, just I was leaving the House and telling my daughter about that, you know, this is my first day session. And she says, and you know, she was 8 when I started here. Now she's going to be a doctor in June. She says, talk to you in July, Dad. So, but Mazel Malik with Legislative Revenue Office, an old guy. I'm going to go through some of the stuff here that you might find in your tax packet, but I always like to go through it as part of the presentations. We put together this table of taxes that we collect in Oregon. And we put this table together in order to give you a flavor of what taxes are collected in the state. And remember, these are all termed as taxes, or most of them are taxes. These, none of those are primarily fees or charges or so on. So all the ones that we have here whoops, just move. It's moved too much. Anyhow, all the ones that we have in the table are taxes. You would see some of them. We start with the big boys, the personal income tax and the unemployment insurance taxes. These are the bigger ones. Then you have the corporate income. You have the weight mile, cigarette taxes. And then there are small, teeny, tiny taxes like the boxing tax. Whether you paid tax the last time you boxed or not, we should probably inquire about that.
Mid-March around here.
And this is also, it also applies for martial arts and, you know, the cage fights and stuff. So if that's your preferred sport.
We transferred that to the state police in this committee.
So, the state lodging tax. So all of these are taxes. The only one that is a strange tax is the medical provider tax. And the medical provider tax, which is about $715 million in a year, this by itself is used to leverage more federal funds. And if you sum all of these taxes together that we look at from the state system, this is about $13 billion. That's the ones that we have here. This is not including liquor sales. Liquor sales is about $475 million a year. Or lottery funds at $750. And then, of course, you have federal funds that are coming through the state. And not all of these are necessarily going through the state expenditure. They come in different flavors, but there's $11.7 billion of those in a year, in this year. Fees and licenses, and these are the categories that you saw at different times, and I think yesterday you saw some of those, but so you saw them in biennial amounts. You have fees and licenses at $950 million. Bonds and bonds revenue, we see the bonds as they sell and come to the state, they're considered as revenue. Interest is $15 billion, as in the budget. That's a chunk of change. A lot of that is of course, interest that occurs on PERS accounts and on unemployment insurance accounts, because those have a big amount that it stays. And the money that comes in as interest has to still come in through the state budget process or the state revenue system, because if the state is a big box, everything that comes through it has to be accounted for that way. So that's why you have big amounts of money. It doesn't mean that you could spend them. Of course, under certain conditions, you could. Donations, and then charges for service and other revenue at $1.65 billion. Your total funds per year, or for the current year, the current fiscal year, is about $43.4 billion. That's what would be comparable to your all funds budget, in a sense. Having done that, we go to the transportation. And I think we've given you a presentation about a month and a half ago or so about the work on the transportation and the transportation funding package. And I know you wanted the new stuff and the new stuff that might be more relevant at this time. And of course, you know, as I said, I feel old. I was telling Kate earlier, the way the orientation usually for the House committee is like you're giving for a new class, freshman. But when you come to the Senate, you're giving the orientation for like cynical graduate students that necessarily. So. Not necessarily I'm thinking you're cynical or anything, but so that the increases in the 10 cents in the gas tax comes in 4 cents in January 2018, moving to from 30 cents to 34 cents. And then, of course, January 2020, you increase to 2 cents, conditional. Also 2022 is 2 cents conditional. And that continues for another 2 cents conditional until you get the 40 cents based on OTC reports. Registration fees also increase on January 1st, 2018. So everybody's paying more starting January, a year away from now. And until December 31st, 2019, that will change. And so is title fees, and of course the new tax on the privilege tax. However, the increases in the weight mile also and the flat fees are about 53% in four increments. 25%, the biggest one happens at 18, and this was on the request of the industry that they wanted to include it at the beginning. So it carries through with time. And then 5% and 5% in 20 and 2022 and 6% finally in an increase in 2024. Now, as you know, there was different ways in the package and, you know, also the veterans of the Joint Transportation Committee, Senator Benz and Senator Tyler, they have seen all of that again, and of course the co-chair Senator Boquist have worked with this idea quite a bit. This is the layered transportation registration fee and layered title fees with the electric vehicle.
He's the one doing it now, not me. You can blame him.
For what part of it?
For the new part. It's coming.
You know, this was not successful at all when it was done, and nobody got heart attacks at that time, by the way. So,
no, but contrary to popular belief, there was a lot of whiskey consumed in this particular one.
It's okay. It doesn't. It's not taxed.
It was not taxed on it right now.
So the fee schedule again. However, out of all of this stuff, just not to get too hung up with House Bill 2017, this is how transportation revenue have looked like in a while. And you could see here how the jump happens in 2018. This is the 2018 fiscal year, and immediately you could feel the increase. Although the increases go through in a 10-year period, that you could almost immediately see the new increases. And of course, you also see that in the distribution between city, county, and state shares. That also happens out. And that's basically on transportation that we'll give you for now. But there are certain things that are coming through transportation, and I am sure that it will happen through different committees. As you know, there are the Joint Transportation Committee, and then there is the Carbon Reduction Committee. And in the carbon reduction interim, we gave a presentation on how the intersection between those two occur. And that kind of thing probably would be, if that's at all interesting to you, of course, you're the taxing committee, after all, the tax policy committee. And if that understanding all the connections between these two is important to you and you want to know, we probably could bring that presentation. Senator Benz probably saw some of that, but and Mr. Chair, you could let us know if that is something that you would like to look at at a good time. And moving from transportation, I do these days I don't do too many sin taxes. I only do the serious ones. So alcohol, beer and wine for once. So our taxes are on a privilege tax basis for the beer at $2.60 per barrel, and each barrel is 31 gallon, at least most barrels are. So it comes to about 8.4 cents per gallon of that of beer, and tax on wine is 67 per gallon, or 70 and 77 cents per gallon of dessert wine. This is the high dessert wine. I haven't had dessert wine. I don't know why people necessarily enjoy it, but it's high content of alcohol. The distribution of this revenue, the interesting thing about it is the 2 cents, the first 2 cents of the wine tax goes to the wine board. That is the, not marketing, but the research board for Oregon wine, if you will. And then 50% of the remaining beer and wine taxes transfer to the mental health and drug abuse prevention. So that's before anything happens or touches it. And then the balance of that money from the beer and wine immediately goes to the OLCC account. In the OLCC account, it's joined by the other liquor revenue, which is the hard alcohol. But however, to give you an idea of what the liquor revenue versus beer and wine, the top line is the liquor revenue, and the blue line in the bottom is the beer and wine. And you could see how steady and small the amounts are compared to the liquor. However, they grew from 11 million in 93 to about 18 million. But if you see the increase and the jump and the escalation of the revenue that is coming from hard liquor, from distilled spirits, going from 62, which was almost comparable to beer and wine in 93, to about 277 million today. That is a big increase. So all of that money that after these initial distributions distributes in a different way, and I'll show you that in a minute. But first, why we don't include the distilled spirits in the taxation picture, not here and not in the first slide, if you remember from the taxes. We don't think of it as a tax because it's a markup process. In the markup process, the OLCC brings in all the liquor with a cost, and then they mark it up about 100%, and then they sell it. They take away their costs, and then to the account, they transfer the net. That becomes eligible for distribution. And these two lines and these two numbers are the difference between that sales or that sale number by the OLCC and their what they distribute back to the government entities. So and those are... It didn't pick up the years, but this is the number 26 is the year 18. I remember it's the same thing as this year, 93 to 18. In 18, the sales number were about 319 million, and the net number is 277. So that 34 million dollars was the cost to deduct. Now, the revenues in the OLCC account, remember that what comes from 50% beer and wine, and then the amounts that come from the liquor distributes to cities, counties, general fund, mental health, and the wine board, of course. And general fund gets about 59% of that, 56% is the lion's share, and then the second largest would be the cities, because the cities gets two distribution, one in formula, and one goes back all the way to the time when the state came and did prohibition of taxation of liquor, alcohol, basically, because previously it used to be the cities who used to do it. The state came and said, moratorium, nobody does it again. We'll take your taxation and we'll give you back this amount, which is about 14% by that formula to kind of give you compensation of what you have lost in taxing power.
I'm just curious here. So after Prohibition, we first turned it over to the cities and the cities ran the liquor business?
Actually, after Prohibition, remember the federal government took their hands off. They said, right, we're not going to touch this. You states go and do your thing. And some states, and Oregon was one of them, we also said, well, you know, we really don't know how to do this. And so cities and counties go and do your thing. So they did. And after a while, we said, well, you know, actually, it was a bad idea. So we did it. And the agreement was to compensate for your loss in revenue, we would do that formula for you. I wasn't present then, not in the legislative revenue office, at least.
You were just in college then, right?
So, if you, and this might be a busy chart, but basically this is all the states, and the first set of columns, oops, this set of columns is for beer, and it basically takes the state, the excise tax on beer, and then tries to include the sales tax of that state on beer, and only the state, not the local, because a lot of states have, you know, local taxes, take only the state excise tax, I mean sales tax, adds them together somewhere else, and then ranks all the states by tax rate. And in that, you see that Oregon is the lowest in beer, the lowest tax rate state for that beer and malt liquor. In wine, same idea. However, the Oregon is not necessarily the last, because there are some other places that don't tax wine independently of their own excise tax. So states apply different sales tax to different to different products. Some states do not tax alcoholic beverages accordingly. And then the distilled spirits, of course, it's a mixed picture because there are a few left, about 17 or so, that are state-controlled, just like the state of Oregon. Where, and the state-controlled is not necessarily all like the state of Oregon. We have the ultimate way of doing it. Or actually, the ultimate way of doing it was the state of Washington before they privatized, where the state brings the liquor in, warehouses it, distributes it, and also owns and runs the liquor stores. That's how the state of Washington did it. We have it slightly more liberalized because we do all, the state brings it in, warehouses it, distributes it, but the liquor stores are not owned by the state. They're franchises, so they can do that. Different arrangements, of course, for the state-controlled areas. And a few years ago, the state of Washington went through a privatization process. And through that, I'm sure you recall a lot of the differences in prices that we started seeing with the state of Washington. Because they needed to show a revenue neutrality at that time in the ballot measure, they included a very high payment, very high tax on the sales. So what ended up being in order to compensate, and they put it only for about 5 years. And then after 5 years, the tax drops down. That's how that ballot measure, and that's how the ballot measure sponsors were able to say the state will not lose any revenue. And therefore, it wasn't the first time, but by that time, I'm not sure it was the third, fourth, something, it passed. And however, contrary to what you would think, when privatization happens and prices would go down, actually prices went up because there was need for compensation for this tax that was promised to make it revenue neutral. So everybody pushed the prices up for such a long time, and then we had this influx of people from Washington coming and buying in the state-owned stores in Oregon versus Washington. So having said that, let's continue to the serious sin taxes. Marijuana revenue legalization initiative was in 2014, and remember the legalization initiative was a harvest tax for marijuana, 35 cents per ounce, not 35 cents, $35 per ounce. But by the time we came to the session in 2015 and started looking at this, this started to look like this is the old way of doing and thinking about marijuana. People don't do ounces anymore. Not that I know, I just learned through the process. There is a lot of products that are part of the legalization that comes through. And part of the legalization process is the things that you have, the topicals, the chocolates, the infused, the purified products, and so on. And today, if you look at the sales of marijuana, you'd see about half, or well, 46% of the sales are all these new products that would not have happened without legalization. I mean, think about somebody on the corner street trying to say, well, I have some infused Kit Kats in my pocket, and it's not necessarily going to sell to anybody. Nobody's going to buy that. But as a product of the legalization, this started coming in. And by House Bill 3400, there was more, of course, more bills, but 3400 held the heft and the tax, the 2015 session. And you know, people thought we're done with marijuana by passing Measure 91, and House Bill 3400 was something about 460 pages of regulation to fix what needs to be fixed. So the tax was changed to 17% point of sale and 3% optional for local government. Also, C will take implementation. However, Department of Revenue was the collecting agency because their ability and experience in collecting, especially a tax that would be paid a lot of it in cash. So the expectation at the time of Measure 91, when we did the Measure 91 estimates, we thought that marijuana will give us about $22 million a year in harvest tax. By the time it was changed to a point of sale tax of 17% by House Bill 3400, we projected about $35 million at the point of sale. And the difference was because at the point of sale, you delay the tax and therefore the price escalation or the markup. And so it reaches the consumer at a lower price. And at least that kind of allows for the legal market to compete more with the illicit or illegal market. Anyhow, $35 million. And that was at a price point that we saw at that time at about $160. And I'm happy to say that the minute or the day, actually, we started looking at prices, we actually did hit that price. And that was very gratifying to know that we hit that price. However, we hit that price only for 1 month. And then it started going down so quickly that there was a lot more of the legal market taking more and more away from the illicit market, because it doesn't make sense for anybody to go buy in the illicit market. If you can get it on the legal market of a better quality, higher regulation, higher abilities, more safety, the lights are on, you don't have to, you know, be in the corner street for a lot less. So as the price went down, the black market started being squeezed. And by 2017, of course, you know, not to consider the early start program at 25%, but that caught us and everybody else by surprise. However, the revenue collection in 2017 got to about $74 million. That's how we, at that, we were thinking at $35 million, we would have one-third legal, two-third illegal in the market. At $74 million, we think we're probably at about 70% legal legal market domination or market share. And in 2018, we reached $95 million. We expect about 105 million for the coming few years. And we expect that to push the illicit market almost completely out in a lot sooner time than we thought previously. We thought a decade in the past. Now I think about 4 to 5 years that would probably be accomplished, because it will not be profitable any longer to be in the illicit market.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hass. Perhaps you're going to cover this, but and I know this has come up before in committee about all the revenue that's not being collected because of the illegal sales. Is there not necessarily LRO, but are, what's happening, do you happen to know, with the coordination of trying to figure out about the revenue that is not being collected in marijuana?
In the marijuana?
And because it's not being sold through the proper channels?
Well, see, I think what the problem that we see in the marijuana markets is that there is an excess or excessive amounts of production. There is one million pounds more than we could consume. Not smoke. We don't smoke marijuana anymore. It's not the preferred way of consumption. So what happens with this is primarily that amount is not being consumed. It's out there. So it's putting pressure on the price, because there's a lot of supply and not enough demand to do it. And we cannot export that amount because it's illegal to export it. So the price starts dropping. So the price starts dropping, and then people say there are some people who are stuck with a lot of supply in their hands. What do they do with it? Well, what do they do with it is they would have to sell it somewhere else, or we have to destroy it. And of course, I cannot testify to how the level of destruction that is happening, but you know it might migrate somewhere else. But what it does is still, in effect, it still pushes the price down, and by pushing the price down, yes, the amount of tax would be less because it's on the point of sale, so it's on the price of the product. But at the same time, it is pushing a lot more of the illegal stuff that needs to otherwise work outside the system. It's pushing it out because it doesn't make enough profit for anybody now to be competing with $2 a gram. You don't want to, you can't produce it any cheaper than this. And if you can't produce it any cheaper than this, you cannot sell it in the market. How are you going to make profit? Why engage in something that is illegal why would somebody go and buy the product from somebody that is illegal and you don't know the quality of the product, while you can go to the state store or store regulated by state. The quantity and the quality is inspected by the Department of Agriculture. It's pesticide free. It's insecticide free. It is chemicals free. Not only that, it is something, a transaction that is happening in the daylight. There is no so the production problem is actually helping stabilize a taxation issue, interestingly enough. Does that make sense, or?
There was a punch for the ex-bonus.
So after the deduction of costs, and those were both all CC and department revenue, we have this distribution of marijuana revenue, the 5% for the abuse prevention. Cities and counties, each of them get about 10%. And when it's distributed among like cities and counties that do not engage in the dry counties or dry cities, if you will, and they have statutory formula that we've worked last session to include them in population and in need. And state police gets 15%, 20% mental health, and the 40% still goes to the state school fund. And that was changed from the previous Measure 35, Measure 91, when it said go to the state state school fund. And this is the endowment fund. What's the name of the fund? The Common School Fund, right? It's not common. See, it's
that was the language in the initiative.
Yeah. Sure. And we fixed that
by a mistake.
Or not necessarily knowing how those. I mean, they're all school funds, right? It's, common, not common. So it sounded right, but I don't think they consulted with LC. Let me put it this way.
I don't think they did.
No.
Senator Vance on marijuana.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It happens that Ontario is located on the border with a state that prohibits use of marijuana, and the city recently voted to legalize the recreational sale of marijuana, resulted in kind of a land rush into the town, which resulted in my looking very closely at a lot of the money laundering federal laws that apply to that particular economic activity. They still are totally applicable, and nothing's been done to change them. The federal memo that came out, Cole memo, outlines 8 different
conditions.
Exactly. One of which is that you won't sell into a state where it's illegal. If you go to any of the stores in Huntington, which is some 40 miles away, about 80% of the cars there are from Idaho. It's anticipated they're going to drive back into Idaho. And I anticipate that that'll repeat in the Ontario area. There's no doubt that a huge volume of traffic will come out of that state into Oregon. The city of Ontario has asked for a bill raising the tax on marijuana to utilize the funds for law enforcement and education. And I guess I'm asking you, given your familiarity with the topic, if despite the fact that the best tax is one you levy on people from other states, the impact, the black market impact on an increase of the price for those purposes, any thoughts?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Vance, I think if you would have asked me 2 years ago, I would say you really don't want to tax too much because you don't want to allow the black market to persist. Nowadays, the black market is almost to the point of drying out. The 3% that is in law allowed for the cities, and I presume Ontario is having 3% tax already, but you're talking about additional amounts that might open up. Having this unique location and unique geography and this spot in almost a desert of prohibition.
Almost.
Yeah, this is almost like a watering hole tax, if you will, you know. And that's,
and that. Well, you want to make it a watering hole tax, Senator Vance.
That's what it should be.
And I think it's probably something that kind of, as you described it, it taxes the French, and that's probably the most favorable tax that, that you can come up with, if it's allowed to happen. However, it can't, or it's difficult to only do it for one city. I'm sure other cities would like to engage in that. Now, when you have all the cities doing it all at once, that pushes the prices all together up. If cities do it and others don't, as we saw, then the general amount doesn't change because, you know, the difference between Beaverton and Tigard is one street in Shoals Ferry, right? So that doesn't make sense if you increase the tax in Beaverton and Tigard doesn't collect the tax. So in different localities, different geographies, it makes difference. I can see how it makes perfect sense for the city of Ontario.
Could you not that I'm condoning this, especially as my good colleague to my far left out here, Desert Oasis, okay? We have, in the past, built tax models on frontier counties.
Sure.
Could you not easily make the argument that the cost of law enforcement and the cost of services are different in the frontier counties than they are in the other counties, and therefore not affect your assumption of the black market rate? Because your consumption rate, you would assume, unless you were in an oasis, in a frontier county is going to be based on population. Yeah, that might make several people recently appointed as deputy U.S. attorneys a little nervous. But having said that, we have done that in the past. You'll recall way back when we did some of our medical stuff and some of the deductions based on frontier counties. And I don't remember the frontier counties, but they are frontier counties.
Rural counties, medical.
And I happen to know that this particular county in question used to be a frontier county.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, I think you can find the language to do it. The idea is you, in a taxation policy, you would always want to maintain this equal tax kind of thing. However, as we were just talking, in this instance, it seems to have you're not taxing two different people differently. Although, I mean, if this was not under the prohibition of the federal government, you could almost think of it how it might violate the Hobbs Clause. But because of the
it's already illegal.
So, but it's, you know, I think it has a merit to look into. I think we probably could explore this more.
Senator Ben. Thank you. I think there will be the opportunity to do that because I think we're going to bring the bill this session, so we'll have an opportunity. But pursuing the illegality at the federal level issue for just a moment, it was apparent in the research that we did that anyone who chose to accept wheelbarrows of cash from folks that are generating it through these kinds of sales was immediately guilty on the face of it of assisting in money laundering under the federal law.
Right.
This resulted in very few people wanting to assist in any way in any of the transactions that then began to occur involving big heaps of that type of money. My question here is, obviously, the question is, that 90, was it 96 million?
Million, right.
Brought in, I'm going to guess a whole bunch of it's in cash, truckloads of it. And I'm just curious if we can get the names of the people that are actually, you know, accepting it and counting it and dumping it into the state coffers. Because I wonder how the state avoids the same exposure.
It's actually right across the street if you haven't visited it.
Yeah.
It's interesting to visit.
I think this sure probably a field trip that we should take
to the
Department of Revenue to visit visit the cash rule. Because the Department of Revenue at a certain time when this started actually had to build a cash room and counting machines and so on because they expected that to happen. Therefore, the whole thing happens in cash. And it's probably not truckloads, but quarter ounce bags of cash will be more appropriate. So, the transactions in cash. Now, there are the legal big stick that the federal government holds, and there is the practical political theory that you would want to look at. I mean, the federal government could say, yes, we will do this and we will do that. And it probably could impose things of that sort. However, if what they're imposing is a type of not really rational, or is it behind times, and things are going in a political theory, organizational, legal thing or the other way, I think that the federal government is probably will end up in the same position that it ended up with in the abolition of the prohibition on this issue, saying with time that we will let this thing go, but hands off, we're not going to touch it. The states do it. You end up with a patchwork of states. Some legalize and some don't. I mean, you go to Texas and you still have dry counties until today. That's or other places.
In most states, actually.
So some places might not legalize in 20 years or 30 years or so on. But I think the if the federal government wanted to actually use that, not the capital in the sense of actual dollars, but the federal capital and strike hard on everybody, it had the chance. I don't think it probably would be wise or advisable that they do, and I think time is changing. That's my analysis as somebody who's been around this issue for a while.
Thank you.
And finally,
well, I'm not going to Huntington anytime soon. Yeah. The Wild West out there.
All been waiting for the transient lodging tax. And just a quick reminder: in 1930, actually, the Bureau for Visitors and so on was part of the State Highway Commission. So even remember, the State Highway Commission used to do a lot of things at that time. Then it became part of Oregon Economic Development in the year 2003. House Bill 2267 decided to make Oregon the Tourism Commission an independent agency. And independence, at that time it was Governor Kolongowski who negotiated, or his officer negotiated that. Independent agency in this sense, it's the budget actually does not go through Ways and Means. So this is a strange duck of a tax, because unlike lottery, see, lottery came through also an initiative, but remember, lottery was there was a prohibition against gambling. So when it was legalized for the purpose of lottery, it was allowed to go through. Lottery does not also go through Ways and Means in the most traditional sense. It comes through two Ways and Means and presents budget, but doesn't get an appropriation to spend from Ways and Means. But lottery brings the money in. This thing is the opposite. This thing, the state brings the money, the state collects and gives it to an independent agency. That is not a state agency to spend it. So, and at that time, the 1% transient lodging tax to help fund the tourism commission, and was collected by the Department of Revenue, the state agency that was collecting it, and it gave 80% to tourism marketing programs and 15% to regional marketing programs. And of course, with that also came a moratorium on local government's ability to tax transient lodging. And I don't know how many, I know some of you have been around and you've seen those battles that they occurred on the transient lodging tax, but it wasn't pretty. So that in 2000 law, the 2000 law came, and as I said, we did the moratorium on the local government. Then they required 70% of net revenue. If the local government would establish a new tax, then it has to spend 70% of that new tax of the city or the county on tourism and promotion of tourism and related facilities. To date, when that grandfather in happened, there was 84 cities and 15 counties that levy and collect and administer transient lodging tax. So in 2005, tinkered with that to define what is and what's not. And in 2013, and I think the bill passed through your committee, this is the one, if you recall, that defines what is transient lodging intermediary and not, put the internet companies, the OTCs, into the mix of collection, and that they will collect and transmit. House Bill 4146 also happened in 2016, and Mr. Chair, this was the last bill, if you remember, if you recall, that went out of your committee on that.
I remember that day vividly.
Yes, it was a very interesting day.
It was an interesting day.
And almost didn't happen, but it did. And it increased the rate to about 1.8% for a period between July 1st, 2016 and July 1st, 2020. After that, the tax drops down to 1.5%. And the amount with that was meant to be a lot of it used for the new allowance of things as the sporting events. This is for the Eugene, what do you call it, race track, world track. And it also changed couple of things in the distribution. So it's, instead of 80%, now it's 65% goes to tourism program, and 20% to be implemented for regional cooperative, and 10% also for the related tourism related facilities and events. Now, this is how the TLT, or transient lodging tax collection, you see, and you see in the year 2017 the jump of revenues coming in, and also in 2018 as a result of that increase in the tax. Of course, some of it is increase in the activity itself, but the increase in the tax is significant, and now it's about $38.4 million a year, which soon it will become real money. But remember, this is again a tax that the state collects, but the expenditure is in a quasi-private public kind of entity that doesn't necessarily go through an appropriation or limitation. That's what I have for you.
Okay.
I hope you had as much fun as I did in this.
Absolutely. It's about the same.
Thank you. From transportation to marijuana to track and field events. Thank you for your patience today. We'll
go through one more round of updates on tax policy tomorrow, and then we'll hit the ground with some legislation, maybe pass some things out next week. Okay? We are adjourned.
Passed a bill yesterday.